I'm going to talk about work that's really been ongoing for a long, long, long time. But I guess I was first involved with all this stuff back in the early 70s. But more recently, I've been involved with Paul Roberts. He got involved with NSF project on subgrid-scale modeling, and he was looking at work that Daryl Holm was doing in relation to all this, and he said, well, your early work in this area, we ought to be able to do something here. So that's how I got back into it about 10 years ago. The pictures that I've got here are actually rather a lot. Now, I was trying to work out what best to do here. You could either get rid of half of them, which seemed to me a little bit daft, but obviously one doesn't show them all, or one shows a subset of them. So the process, the basis I'm working on is I'm going to skip around the pictures that I've got, and of course the whole lot will be on the web so that you can browse through the details. So let me just see where we're going. Certainly from the subgrid scale stuff, we were just thinking, well, we've got lots of scales we want to model, from large scale right down to small scales. And there's a sort of, between the sort of viscous length scales and the large scale length scales, sort of an intermediate length scale where dissipation is still reasonably unimportant, and viscosity can be neglected even though you're on small length scales. So that was the motivation in that area of work. So for this, quite often one wants to use Lagrangian methods, and my own area is MHD systems, and in that area it's very well known that Lagrangian methods are particularly useful, because magnetic fields that don't diffuse are frozen to the fluid, and all you've got to do is follow where the fluid particles move, and you can work out what the magnetic field is because it's frozen to the fluid. Now, and the same, of course, with advection of scalars. Well, it's just the temperature or something, it just moves with the fluid. So if you were to follow the position of a... Let's see if I can work this thing next, I suppose. If you could follow the position of a fluid particle, you'd know everything about what was going on. Now the MHD situation, one's interesting, and I'll go through, explain some of this in a moment. But if you've got magnetic field lines which are more or less frozen to the fluid, and if they're in a shear flow, so the shear is going over the field without moving it, the Lagrangian representation isn't too good in the shear, because the fluid particles move further and further apart. So it's all you really want to do is chase up where the field lines are. So rather than following material particles, you just want to follow labels which link you to the field lines. And in that case, it's better, rather than just working with the Lagrangian displacement, which just increases indefinitely, is just to not actually move with the fluid itself, but just suitably chosen points on the field lines. And I guess that's what this is all about. Right, that's what I've just said down here. And this idea is the same as what Oliver was just describing in the geophysical context. So I came into this area through dynamo problems back in 72, and Michael McIntyre was interested more in the geophysics and the dynamics. Ours was primarily kinematics. Right, now, in order to deal with these Lagrangian techniques, I want to get this out of the way straight away so you can see where I'm coming from. Basically, when we want to have an apparatus for dealing with Lagrangian displacement, so we'll use X for our position. We displace the position to neighboring point XL, that's PL, and we'll use the notation that the star variables are physical variables, and if we want to know their value at the displaced position, we denote it by the subscript L. And you can think of this in two ways. I mean, originally, you're thinking in terms of, oh, well, we've got distortion of the field line, so we want labels for the field lines. But you can also think of it in an alternative point of view as a coordinate transformation. And that's actually quite vital in how we want to proceed. So all these things, like a tensor quantity, it's convenient to evaluate that tensor quantity by using transformation laws, and this is the ordinary general tensor transformation law. And okay. So just as I say, this is just a sort of math methods just to get started. So for example, temperature, once you move to the new position, it transforms, the theta is the transformation of that, whereas density, if the transformation doesn't preserve volume, you've got to take account of the Jacobian. If you have a velocity field, the velocity field at the displaced point is this u dot the gradient of the coordinate transformation. If you take the mass flux...
Sorry, but what is the significance of the star?
The star is the physical variable. Yes, and it's the physical variable. Well, just ordinary. It's an ordinary physical variable. It's a function of position. So u star, yeah, go back. Yeah, it's up there. So the physical variable is t star. And if you want to work it out, t star is a function of a variable x. But if you want to know its value at a displaced point, xl, it's t star at the displaced point, which you denote with the star with the L on it. Ah, well, that's because this is the definition of the unstarred variable. That's its definition. That's the definition of the unstarred quantity. It's just this is just a tensor transformation, coordinate transformation. So the original variable in one frame is t star, and that's its value in the transformed frame. Yeah. So that's right. So the example on the next one, theta is this is thinking it more of a coordinate transformation. Temperature doesn't change just because you use different coordinates. But density does, or it might do. Because if you compress the coordinate system, you're going to change the density in that new frame. Right, so a lot of variables are basically contravariant vectors, but make the distinction for when you're dealing with momentum, which if it's constant, it's basically you want to make the distinction between the momentum velocity and the ordinary convective velocity. When you're dealing with the equation of motion, you want to deal with the velocity as a covariant vector rather than a contravariant vector. Right. Now, the next thing that's important in where we're going is this idea of a Lie derivative. In its general form, it's just the expression at the top. But if you take some specific Cartesian examples of that, the Lie derivative of temperature would be eta dot grad, with respect to the variable eta, that is. And you get these normal things that look reasonably familiar. But let's just keep moving on. Right. Okay. Now, this is really where I came in. I think 64 is a nice date, isn't it? 50 years ago, Braginsky introduced a geodynamo model, which was very interesting because it was at the stage where people were still trying to prove that geodynamo models worked. And his example is absolutely perfect for describing this hybrid Eulerian Lagrangian method, though he didn't use it. So he was considered primarily with planetary interiors, where the main motion was azimuthal motion. You have a mean, you can think of a mean azimuthal motion, mean density, and so on. And as we've heard in the last talk, you can decompose the motion into, we're talking Eulerian at the moment, mean and fluctuating parts, all very standard. Now, if you're dealing with a situation which doesn't involve much dissipation, there's a method for dealing with fluctuations, which appears to go back to Freeman and Rothenberg in the 60s, whereby you introduce a displacement vector so that the fluctuating velocity is essentially the material derivative of eta with respect to the mean velocity plus minus eta dot grad u bar, and that gives you a description of the velocity. It in fact is written in the form of, and this is important for what follows, d by dt of eta minus the lead derivative of u bar, where the lead derivative is that for a contravariant vector weight 0. And he chose zeta to have 0 mean. Then you can represent the fluctuating velocity, density, magnetic field, all in terms of lead derivatives. Okay, that's the sort of basics. Now I think I'll go on, in case I'm rushed, right to the end. right, and let's expand on Braginsky's model. Some don't take too much notice of all the details, because this is actually using the hybrid Eulerian Lagrangian formulation. But let's look at what the issues are. You've got the magnetic induction equation with the evective term and the diffusion term. And you can put this in hybrid Eulerian Lagrangian form, but let's bypass that for the moment. What he wanted to do was have a primarily azimuthal flow magnetic field, and then small mean meridional motions and fluctuating fields. Now, the interesting thing about the scaling here is that the fluctuating velocity is the relatively big one relative to the mean flow. It's order rm to the minus a half, and the mean bits are order rm to the minus one. So, and that the rm is the magnetic induction equation. Now, the idea here is, well, let's keep going. I think that's the best idea. The idea is to consider the mean fields. So you're writing, have I skipped a slide? Where's the A defined? Oh yes, it was there. Yes, so you've got vector potentials for the meridional motion and magnetic field. So the stream function for the meridional flow, magnetic vector potential A for the meridional flow. Now you decompose the magnetic induction equation into its mean part, into its azimuthal bit, and you extract the vector potential for the meridional magnetic field. And you get, when you're dealing with the mean field equations, you get a situation, because these, remember, these are A star and B star phi are mean quantities. You get the usual nonlinear fluctuation terms, which you average, and they form the sources. And the interesting, and I think this is relevant to see where this is all coming from, these things are actually quite big. When you chase up the scalings, that term is as big as that. This term is quite big in its own right. But the first obvious problem is that one's as big as that term. And it's at this stage you think you get a right mess, because what you're after in dynamo theory is a way of linking the A to the B. If you don't have that, A just diffuses, and without the A, you can't produce the azimuthal field. So this is really very important that you get that. And if you were to try and do this naively, this term at low order just absorbs into that term in a way that I'll describe. So I've called these the GLM equations, but for the moment don't think of them like that. You can redefine your U so that nonlinear term is absorbed in there. You also got to redefine your A, so that nonlinear term was taken in. And the other thing that happens is that the diffusion term actually comes in like what's known in dynamo theory as an alpha effect, and that provides you the source for the meridional magnetic field. And the once you do, what I was doing in all this was, Braginsky did this all from an Eulerian point of view, and then I noticed that this could be done much nicer from a Lagrangian point of view, and then you get sort of nice interpretations for that term, which is a sort of alpha effect, which is a measure of the twisting of the magnetic field, and so on. Right. Now, yeah, and this is really where I want to be I want to make an important point here, because what one's done is, what he did was introduce what he called effective variables. The stream function was modified from the original stream function. The A is a modification of the original A, and the modification comes through this nonlinear term, and you notice the alpha effect is written like that. Now, the thing to notice here is that it's Eulerian. There's nothing Lagrangian about this statement at all. We've got equations set up in an Eulerian form. And I want to stress this really strongly, because the way one's going is, and I remember Paul said to me very early on when he'd shown this to Braginsky, he said, oh, it's all very interesting, but how do you solve problems with this Lagrangian stuff? At that point, it sort of bothered me then, and it's bothered me ever since. And it really comes back to what Darrell Holm was doing. He was saying, well, we should be thinking of a, rather than doing it in a Lagrangian sense, it would be nice to have an equivalent of GLM in an Eulerian sense. So where I want to go is to have something which is totally Eulerian. This is Eulerian. There's nothing Lagrangian about it. Now, my attitude is, I think of these more from an asymptotic point of view, small amplitude expansions. I want to know the best way to solve the problem. Now, GLM tells you and gives you physical idea of what's going on, but what you really want to know is, I mean, this is what you want. You want the equations that Braginsky got. You want to know what these new variables are and so on, and you've got them in a concrete form. And this also goes for the averaging. In this framework, there's nothing Lagrangian about the averaging. It's an Eulerian average. These are all Eulerian averages. So if you do an azimuthal average, it isn't round some distorted contour or something. It's round the original azimuthal phi angle. So the quantities one's getting are Eulerian. So the objective is to say, well, GLM is very nice, but we want to have all its variables defined in an Eulerian sense. And so that's where one's heading. Okay. Maybe it is. I'm not that familiar with the atmospheric literature, so maybe it is.
To clarify, GLM doesn't do everything you want exactly, and GLM, in a certain sense, does, as Oliver, I think, has explained quite well.
I know TEM doesn't do everything you want, and I think if I understand what Andrew just said, this doesn't do everything you want either, by itself.
Well, what do you mean it doesn't do what you want? It's got all the equations.
Are we talking about the dynamo problem?
At the moment, we're talking about the dynamo problem.
Right. But is this the same? Well, is it conceptually the same as TEM? It sounds the same. It's completely an Eulerian framework, and you redefine.
Paul says it isn't.
No?
Yeah.
The way you look at it is to think of the mapping involved in all this as a coordinate transformation. And are you talking about strictly Eulerian averaging before or after that transformation? Do we still have a transformation in view that tells you something about particle positions, or are you saying you're completely...
Well, I think maybe we've still got to get to that. Can we save that question for a bit later? I think it's too early. It's too early.
If it's purely Eulerian, then do you mean by that you're not considering particle displacements or particle positions at all?
Well, not yet. I think it's too soon. We haven't really discussed how... I mean, all I'm saying is one's going via the GLM route, or the Eulerian Lagrangian route, and you can do all the stuff you do there, but at the end of the day, you translate it into Eulerian forms. And so even your averages, these are all Eulerian averages in the phi direction.
And are you in ordinary coordinates or transformed?
No, these are cylindrical polar coordinates.
Okay, press on, Andrew.
I think I need to do a bit more.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, okay, so we now go... Have we done this?
I
we've done that. Right, so I guess, let's think, how do we do? I've got to keep pressing this knob, haven't I? This is just the basic things. So the temperature, we've already discussed the temperature, the density, the magnetic field transforms like that. You have to worry about the Jacobian. The Jacobian satisfies sort of conservation equation. One introduces the velocity of the particle at L, which is dxL by dt, which is dxi by dt. So that is an Eulerian velocity, but measured at the at the displaced position. So it's an omega star L. You can construct W star L. You can construct W at that point just by that coordinate transformation.
But that partial d by dt down at the right means you're using the Lagrangian description.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. And then all the sort of quantities you want to deal with, like the temperature, d theta by dt, evaluated at the displaced position, is d theta by dt minus the lead derivative of theta. The density suitably weighted, time derivative of the density suitably weighted goes the same way. The magnetic field suitably weighted, transforms the same way. So you get all these time derivatives become these partial derivatives together with the lead derivatives. The only thing that isn't quite natural in this, I stumbled on this rather late in the day. We know we can transform this velocity in that way, but notationally, you look as though you mixed up the notation here, but it's quite natural. So if you want to deal with the velocity at the displaced point relative to the moving frame, which is that difference, which is the V star L, that is the velocity. Once you've gone to the new frame, you want to talk about a velocity U in the new frame, not a velocity V. So you're sort of switching the U and the V in these transformations, but it works out all right because the W's transform in that way. And this then leads to the notation advantages quickly become clear. The velocity at the Lagrangian position is written like that, which means you can write it as that combination following the definition up there. So you've got the W's got grad dx is the W star L, which is the d eta by dt, which is that bit plus that. So you've got the material derivative in the Lagrangian, in the new frame, is that. Yeah, okay. And once you do that, all these other derivatives transform nicely. If you write that combination down, the time derivative of the temperature plus the lead derivative of the temperature, it just transforms to the same quantity. And that's the advantage of this switching of the velocity fusion. It's invariant. Same with the density, same with the magnetic. No dissipations here. These transform invariantly. And when you go to the momentum equation, that combination transforms invariantly. Just a quick word about the solenoidal conditions. When you chase all these up, you get Jacobians coming in all over the place. And one of the nice things, certainly in the dynamo context where you're thinking of incompressible fluids, you don't really want a transformation which is compressible. You want a transformation for which the Jacobian is 1. Then you have nice properties that the divergence of U star and the divergence of U remain the same. And you can choose div W to be 0 and so on. So the way this goes, just to see how it goes, when you're actually dealing with the ideal equations, which are in this form, magnetic induction, and if you look at the momentum, just balancing momentum and the pressure gradient, that's the slightly modified pressure, these all also transform nicely. So the temperature, the heat conduction equation becomes that, the magnetic induction equation becomes that, and so on. So it all goes through quite nicely. The Coriolis, now, the two reasons for introducing this at this stage. Though I've said everything else transforms nicely, when you write down the Coriolis acceleration, it's not quite a friendly object, such a friendly object. And the best way to write it, I think, in when you're going to use it is in that form. And in a way, this is motivated by what Mike McIntyre did years ago when he wrote down his equations. Basically, he did only did the average, the means of these things, but basically this was would be the form that he would have had. And the R is a slightly curious combination, because having done them all this way, certain Lie derivative properties that we'll need later don't actually hold for the Coriolis acceleration, because it's not a proper tensor. Okay, so where are we going? This is really where we want to get to. How are you going to do an amplitude expansion of all this stuff? It's easy enough to do, but it's a horrible mess. And Paul and I thought, well, we must be... we'd written this sort of summary paper, getting the hybrid Eulerian stuff in order, and he said, we're going to do a small amplitude stuff. And I thought, well, yes, this is miserable. You can expand everything at sight, but so what? And the issue was, how can you do this in a nice way? And in the end, we stumbled on... Well, we came across this independently, but we realized after it was linked to an idea that Keith Moffat had introduced when he looked at magnetostatic equilibria back in 1986, whereby he was considering a magnetic field equilibrium. He wanted to consider it in a different orientation, and he said, well, we won't just use the Lagrangian displacement. We'll imagine this field is convected into this new position. So he had this idea of, rather than displacing the field, convecting it. And that's what the idea that we want to expand on. We're going to get our new field after it's been transformed by convecting it there. All our variables can be convected there. I suppose it wasn't so obvious, well, it wasn't obvious to me or us that there was a similarity with magnetic field or perhaps vorticity in the inviscid fluid. These concepts are quite clear, but the idea of convecting a velocity field is not quite so intuitive. Right, so the idea is, that was the point. The direct expansion in terms of zeta becomes unwieldy. So the idea is to go about it a different way. So we followed up on his idea, and we actually convected the point, used a fictitious velocity, which takes the magnetic field or whatever from to the new coordinates by this flow. It looks a bit strange. It's a steady flow, but it's a steady flow in the fictitious time. So though it's written as a function of x and t, in the fictitious time it's not. It's a steady flow in the fictitious time variable. And it has what struck me as a most remarkable property. In some sense, it looks simple enough. It's remarkable in the sense that this equation is saying something about things at two different points. Eta star L is eta star evaluated at XL, whereas eta is eta evaluated at X. So there's a relation between properties at two different points. But it does turn out to be the same quantity. I showed this stuff to a relativist, and he said it was obvious, but I never understood why it was obvious. So you can expand all these variables, like the displacement, the Jacobian, and the velocity field, and so on, in terms of this eta field. And then what you're actually doing with all your variables is you can write all your Lagrangian variables in terms of Taylor expansions in terms of the Lie derivative using eta. So you're basically, the way to think about it is, like Moffat did, you sort of convect it, but we'll basically think of a Taylor series expansion about tor equals naught. So it's a Maclaurin series in tor, and this is an expansion for the Lagrangian variable in terms of the Eulerian variable. This basically gives you a relation between the Lagrangian variables, the variable in the new coordinate with the... Okay, so why is this important? These are things evaluated. These are things refer to things at two different positions. That theta refers to something at XL, and this is referring to something at X. So this is a relation, gets you a relationship which tells you what theta star at X is, not at XL, at X, in terms of theta, which is naturally defined as properties at the point at the other point. So you're getting theta star expanded at a point in terms of the other quantity, which really refers to another physical variable. That's how these come about. So all your quantities can be described as Lie derivative expansions. Now, one of the nice things from my point of view, because I'm always thinking much more in terms of incompressible flows, is you can choose the Jacobian equal to 1, which is what it did back in 72. This doesn't work very nicely with the GLM approach. There are problems. Okay, so you can keep J equal to 1. There's no problem. The expansion of the Jacobian is in this form, and div equal to 0 does that.
There's actually a divergence effect saying that you can have non-zero J even for
compressible flow.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. We're avoiding that.
So compressible or not is beside the point. It's beside the point.
Oh, okay. So that makes it this better. Okay. Right.
We were very worried about that, by the way. There's a trade-off. One way you get certain advantages, the other way you get others.
Yeah.
Okay, we only have about 8 minutes, so...
8 minutes? I'm doing well.
Think in terms of a soft landing, I think.
Yeah, 8 minutes is fine. 8 minutes is fine. I'm quite happy.
Wait for the mic.
So it's the eta star equals eta business. So suppose you start out with a straight material line, and if this material line sort of got stretched out and contorted and sort of folded over.
Oh, no, we're not interested in that case.
Okay, so then I was...
small amplitude stuff. Okay. No, it's important. This is based on small displacements. Yeah. I mean, yeah, this is small displacement stuff. Okay, so what are we going to do? We know all about this. We had this in the previous talk. I think we do need to start focusing on where the differences now come. So the first thing, the key assumption, I've attributed this to Andrews and McIntyre, but essentially it was the same in the stuff I did with Baginski's. The idea is that the U you introduce should, there should be no fluctuating part to U. And the reason for doing this is quite obvious. Once you start looking at something like the equation of motion, no bells and whistles here, this is just the basic form. It's quite clear, once you average it, then because U has no fluctuating part, you're not played with nonlinear couplings. And the same goes with the magnetic induction equation without diffusion and so on. The magnetic field is then, yeah, exactly so. The magnetic field doesn't have any fluctuating part, the temperature doesn't have any fluctuating, as long as you don't include diffusions. Then you have nice properties. You have things like Kelvin circulation theorem, Alphane's theorem. You have Kelvin's, for the simple Euler's equation, you have a Kelvin circulation theorem for the mean flow. You have frozen flux theorem for the magnetic field. Right, so we're now getting on to the verses, I suppose. GLM, now the crucial assumption about GLM, or relative to what I'm going to describe as little GLM, is that the GLM assumes that mean zeta vanishes. And this has the nice consequence that the average of the velocity U star at the Lagrangian point is simply U. You get these issues like the difference between the momentum and the velocity is a difference which, when you've included the Coriolis force as well, contribution as well, gives you the pseudo-momentum that we heard about in the last talk. Ethyl goes in a slightly different direction. Why do we call it ethyl? Hybrid Eulerian Lagrangian mean, Hyberian Lagrangian. The ET stands for Eulerian transform. So the idea is to go back to Eulerian. So you've done your hybrid Eulerian Lagrangian, but you're aiming back to Eulerian again. So it's natural. You don't have to make this assumption, but you've lost half the benefits of using ETA if you don't. Having introduced ETA, it's quite natural to assume its average vanishes. Then the Lagrangian mean of the velocity is no longer U, but you've got to take into account the material derivative of zeta. And there are other consequences. The pseudo-momentum is slightly different. Of course, the whole transformation is going to be slightly different. It's going to be a slightly different transformation. The xi is going to be different to the xi you get from GLM. The xi you get here, because you still have a xi. The fact that I'm talking about eta, you still have a xi. But the xi for this, the XL, is different for this to GLM. So there are differences. I think we can skim that. I wonder how much more we need here. I think if we're going for a soft landing, I don't think there is much more we essentially need. There is this business that, I'm not ignorant. I did talk about the divergence effect. If you've got mean psi equal to naught, you have problems. You can't have those both vanishing simultaneously, and the divergence of xi vanishing would then implies that the Jacobian is non-zero and div u is non-zero, and the consequences like that.
Just to clarify, what I call the divergence effect was div u bar l equals naught, the Lagrangian mean flow.
Well, that would have been u, wouldn't it?
I'm not sure about all your notation. Anyway, it's not not just a linear, it's not div xi, that's all I'm saying. It's div of mean flow in the way we defined it. That can differ from zero.
When flows. Yeah, but the u would be the... Oh, okay, so you're saying you would like me to... Wait a minute.
Div xi equals naught was what caught my eye there. And, I see, you say div u not equal... So that u is our u bar
L. Yes, that's your u.
Oh, it's our u bar L, righto.
Well, you've got to be a little bit, yes, exactly. So with the GLM assumption, with the mean value of eta vanishing, everything in this context is nice. You have div eta 0, Jacobian of 1, div u is 0, and you just have the zeta expansion for, eta expansion for xi. You can calculate various quantities. I think we should skip this. This isn't directly relevant. And the next step is how you implement all this. The overall strategy is to use X as the independent variable. And the idea is that all your Eulerian variables can be expressed in terms of Lagrangian variables using this Taylor expansion. You can invert it. There's absolutely no difficulty inverting. You can go both directions. You can then take averages of all these things. I think with a soft landing, I'm going to have to start skimming some of this stuff. But basically, all I'm getting at is that you can interchange the relations between the Eulerian. That's the average of t at the position x. You do it on this. These are all things evaluated at x. This is the whole point of this. So these averages of these quantities are the normal averages you do in an Eulerian context. So you're relating the Lagrangian averaging to Eulerian averages. That's really the point here.
Okay, I'm about to exercise.
What's that say? No time left.
This is the nuclear option now. The soft landing didn't work.
No, I think that's it. That's it. That's it. There's nothing else.
We have time for one question. Who wants to ask it?
David Hughes. Andrew, can I just bring you back to what it all means for dynamos then?
Yes.
I mean, we have alpha.
Yes.
How would it work in this framework? What does alpha look like?
Well, alpha is what I showed you earlier on, I guess.
I mean, why is it better than...
Well, you can calculate... These are this eta is really a property of the fluctuating velocity. So you know what eta is. And this is what Baginski did, really. He essentially, no, he didn't do it. He integrated. He did a phi integration, but that gets you your displacement vector. But what you've got here is this is the alpha effect term, and you've got it in terms of averages of these quantities. The eta is something which is easily derivable from the fluctuating velocity.
But they used right. So these are Eulerian
averages.
This
is totally Eulerian.
But when but when Moffat does these things with Lagrangian things, he always is very concerned that these are not going to converge and things. All his answers for Alfred. Have you kind of sidestepped that?
He's thinking in terms of large amplitude stuff when he says that. This is small amplitude stuff.
Right.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Andrew.
Okay.
So we all now have a 29-minute coffee break, and we'll hear Jacques Benes starting at 10 minutes after 11.